At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
You want the truth? Here's the one you'll hate the most. If you hadn't attacked them in their sleep, in the middle of the night, like a pedophile, Kaylee would have kicked your fucking ass. Thank you.
You're watching a High Wire Media podcast.
Kaylee Gonzalez, Zana Kernodle, Ethan Chapin, and Maddie Mogan. These were the 4 young college students whose lives were taken on November 13th, 2022, right outside the University of Idaho campus. All because of one cold-blooded killer, a 28-year-old man named Brian Koberger. This case has been all over the place. It's been discussed up and down. There have been many rumors, gossip, disrespect towards the victims and their families. But if there's one thing, as this case has wrapped up this year, that is left, it's a lot of unanswered questions, honestly, about the entire case. Even though we supposedly have the answers. And that is what we are going to address today. On July 2nd, 2025, 3 years after the murders, Koberger pleaded guilty to all 4 murders, which landed him behind bars for the rest of his life. But this plea deal meant he didn't have to answer many of the pressing questions. What was the motive? Why these 4 victims? And what might have happened if he stood trial after all? Today I'm going to walk you through the case, and then the evidence that would have come out in court, and the new updates and information that has been released since Brian's sentencing. And there might even be some information we're missing, because it seems like there's stuff coming out each and every day. We tried to make this as recent as possible, so if there's some things that are missing, I'm sorry, it's just the way it is. We're really just going to try to unravel what really went on in the mind of Brian Koberger, so we're going to back up. It is Saturday, November 12th, 2022. It is just another weekend in the small town of Moscow, Idaho. The students at the University of Idaho are looking to blow off some steam, get a little partying and fun in before they all return home for Thanksgiving break. One of them was a 20-year-old senior from the Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, named Madison Mogan, or Maddie as her friends called her. Now, Maddie was studying marketing and was a member of a sorority. She was a gentle, warm-hearted girl who was loyal and worked hard to maintain her friendships and connections to her family, including to her friend who she had been close to since sixth grade, who also happened to be her former roommate, 21-year-old Kaylee. Now, Kaylee was originally from, apologies if I say the name wrong, but Rathdrum, Idaho, though she eventually had plans to move to Austin, Texas after graduation, and she was also planning to get a marketing job there. Kaylee was also part of a sorority. She was in a different sorority, though, from Madison and her other roommate, 20-year-old Zana. So now we have 3 roommates, Maddie, Kaylee, and Zana. Zana and Maddie were sorority sisters. Zana had grown up in Idaho, too, but she had also spent some of her childhood in Arizona. Her father described her as a strong-willed and independent, but she had also fallen hard for another college student, a handsome freshman, 20-year-old Ethan Chapin. Ethan, one of the 3 triplets with a brother and a sister, came from Conway, Washington. He was in a fraternity, and as a former basketball player, decided to major in recreation sport and tourism management. So all 4 of these college students seemed incredibly social and outgoing, loving their college life, and dreaming of all the possibilities that the future might hold for them. They had no idea, though, that November 12th would be their last night to celebrate. That evening, Zana and Ethan went to a party at his fraternity house. This was actually just a short walk from the house on King Road where the girls lived. Zana, Kaylee, and Maddie. And they actually had 2 other female roommates that lived in the house on King Road with them. 21-year-old Dylan and Bethany. So Dylan, Bethany, Kaylee, Maddie, and Zana all living together at this house on King Road while going to college. Now as Zana and Ethan are at the party at the fraternity house, Maddie and Kaylee were off at a sports bar in Moscow called the Corner Club. which they actually got to around 10 p.m. that night. Kaylee had actually moved out of the house that she shared with the girls pretty recently, so she had been living there during college, but just moved out. She was actually back that night to hang out with her former roommates, and she was planning to stay the night at her former house. So right before that, Kaylee even uploaded a picture to her Instagram, reading, quote, "One lucky girl to be surrounded by these people every day." And it's kind of a picture that has gone viral because it has all the victims in it together. Now, Bethany and Dylan, the other two roommates, also went out drinking that night, and they returned home around 1 a.m. Kaylee and Maddie stopped at a food truck and called a car, getting home around 1:56 a.m. Meanwhile, Ethan went back to the house with Zanna to spend the night with her at the house, getting home around the same time as Kaylee and Maddie. So almost everyone is back home by 2 a.m. But around 4 a.m. that night, Dylan, whose room was on the same floor as Zanna's, woke up to a strange sound. Now, just to set up the layout of the house for you, because it is a weird constructed house, there are three floors in total in this house at King Road. On the first floor is where Bethany's bedroom is, okay? Only her bedroom's on the first. The second floor is where Zanna and Dylan's bedrooms are. And then the third is where Maddie's bedroom is, as well as where Kaylee's was before she moved out. Now that morning, around 4 a.m., Dylan thinks she can hear. She wakes up and she thinks she hears what sounds like Kaylee maybe playing with a dog on the floor above her. So on the third floor. And then she thinks she hears either Kaylee or Maddie saying something like, "There's someone here." She also says she heard what she thought was crying, eventually coming from Zanna's room down the hall from hers, followed by a male voice saying, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." So she wakes up at 4 a.m. and is like, "What is going on in this house?" She's spooked, she's scared. She decides it's gotten to a point where she's going to stand up and peek out her bedroom door just to kind of see what's going on. So she sticks her head out her bedroom door, and that's when she sees a man in all black clothing in a ski mask walk past her towards a sliding glass door near the rear side of the house. And it is during this time that the man turns and makes eye contact with Dylan. So Dylan says they make eye contact, and she sees that he's a white man with a big nose and bushy eyebrows, and that he's holding some type of, quote, small vacuum type of object. Remember, it is nighttime. She has just woken up. She's trying to grasp what's going on. So Dylan, a little scared, but like the guy didn't hurt her and she doesn't hear anything going on, goes back into her room and calls Bethany. This is the roommate that she was out with earlier, who is asleep on the floor below hers, and she says, "Hey, I was hearing noises. I just think I saw someone dressed in all black, like, wandering through the house." Bethany's like, "Really? Did you say anything?" She's like, "No, she's scared." She's telling Bethany that she's scared, so Bethany says, "Hey, just, like, run downstairs. Come to my room." And Dylan does. So they get down, and they're trying to decide what to do. No one in their right mind believes that their roommates had just been murdered and that they're sitting here alive in the house. Yeah, this case is a little different because I know bits and pieces of it. I know there's been a lot of speculation and opinions and thoughts and judgment. And it's hard because I tried to think back when I was in college. I lived off campus, so like I didn't have roommates particularly, but I could understand, you know, you get a house full of roommates, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. Not saying they partied, you know, hard, but like, you know, there's parties. There's just a lot of stuff going on. You're going to have a lot of noises, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think anybody ever thinks, "Oh, there's a random person in our house right now that's trying to kill us all." Like, I don't know. It's insane. It's out of this world even to think that something like that can happen. I mean, all the stories I've heard where, like, people would come out of their room and there'd be a random boy they've never seen in their house in their dorm room. I mean, it's college life for you. I think sometimes people forget that college life at times can be very just like in and out, strangers all the time. You're constantly meeting new people. Now, granted, if she was like in her family home and there was a man standing there in a ski mask, she would probably be like, "We have an intruder." Oh yeah, she'd probably call her parents and be like, "What the heck is going on?" I also want to note that this is 2022, so we're only about a year and a half out of COVID, so people wearing masks really wasn't that uncommon of a sight. Sure, it's not 2020, but still, I mean, if I see a person in a mask now, I don't really question it. So I think in her gut, she definitely has. She's spooked. Like, she's like, "I don't understand what's happening." She does not believe that her roommates were just murdered, which I think is safe to say. So they're together in the downstairs room trying to figure out what is going on. So then they're trying to call their roommate's phones. It's 4 a.m. No one answers. They don't panic, though, because they figure a couple of things. Dylan only saw, like, a strange man. It's not like she saw any of her other roommates awake and walking around. It is 4 a.m. They might be asleep. I kind of feel like after going through this whole case since 2022 and when they arrested him, I feel like 4 a.m. is a little late to, like, try to sneak into somebody's house. Like, I know it's still dark because it was the dead of winter, but, like, I feel like you could probably get caught if somebody was paying attention. Like, caught by somebody outside. But yeah, like I said, it's 4 a.m. They might be asleep. They might not be answering their phone. And two, they decided to get it together that the man walking through the house was probably just one of Ethan's frat brothers who had come over, maybe like playing a joke on Xana and Ethan or something. That is what they come up with because Ethan is there and he has a whole bunch of frat brothers. Dylan also thinks she might just be entirely mistaken since she was drinking the night before. I think it's really easy that once they were together, they talked each other down off the ledge, found some peace and comfort, and they both finally fell back asleep. Now the next morning around 11 a.m., which seems late, but I mean, they were out till 2, then awake till 4, so around 11 a.m., Bethany wakes up and she notices no one else in the house is up yet except for her and Dylan. So at this point, they're like, wait, they're still not up. So they start sending some text messages to the other roommates via text and Snapchat. But there is still no answer from any of their roommates. And it's around that time that they realize Xana's location is off on her phone, which is weird. Like, they're checking for the location, they realize hers is off. So they decided to walk up and just peek in through Xana's door. And it's at this point that they see Xana passed out on the floor in her underwear and sweatshirt. But that's all they see before they get freaked out and leave the house. They're like, something is definitely wrong here. We need to not be in here. We need help. So at this point, they call two other friends over to help with the situation. People they call are their friend Emily and her boyfriend Hunter Johnson. Now they come over and Hunter goes in the house. They're like, hey, you are a boy and we think you can handle this. So Hunter goes into the house. He walks up to the second floor to Xana's bedroom. He also sees Xana passed out on the floor. And he actually rushes back outside the house and says, hey, we need to call 911. Something's going on. They haven't even walked into the bedroom and let alone gone up to the third floor. They're just so spooked and freaking out. I think it was obviously eerie enough that they're freaking out. It takes a lot for a group of college kids to decide to get serious and call the police.
What is the address of the emergency?
1122.
What is the rest of the address?
Oh, Kings Road.
Okay. And is that a house or an apartment?
It's a house.
Can you repeat the address to make sure that I have it right?
I'll talk to you guys. We live at the White, so we're next to them.
I need someone to repeat the address for verification.
The address? 1122 King Road.
And what's the phone number that you're calling from?
What's your phone number?
And tell me exactly what's going on.
One of the roommates has passed out and she was drunk last night and she's not waking up.
Okay.
Oh, and they saw some man in their house last night. Yeah. Hi, this is
And are you with the patient? Okay, I need someone to keep the phone, stop passing it around.
Can I just tell you what happened pretty much?
What is going on currently? Is someone passed out right now?
I don't really know, but pretty much at 4 a.m.
Okay, I need to know what's going on right now if someone has passed out. Can you find that out?
Yeah, I'll come. Come on, Bethany, we gotta go check. But we have to.
moment. I'm getting help started that way.
Okay, thank you.
And how old is she?
She's 20.
Twenty, you said?
Yes, 20. You're 20.
Okay.
Hello? Hello?
Okay, I need someone to stop passing the phone around because I've talked to four different people.
Okay, sorry, they just gave me the phone.
Is she breathing?
Hello?
Is she breathing?
No.
Okay.
Talking to them, say I can't talk to them. I need you to talk to them.
Okay. Hello.
Okay. I have already sent the ambulance and law enforcement. Stay on the line. Okay. If there is a defibrillator available, send someone to get it now and tell me when you have it.
Say that again. There's a police here right now.
Okay. If there is a defibrillator available, send someone to get it now and tell me when you have it.
We don't have one. I think yes. Do you have a defibrillator?
Yep.
Yes, we have one.
Are you talking to the officer?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to let you go since he's there with you and can help you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Okay.
11:59 a.m. 49 seconds, November 13, 2022.
But I also think people don't take into consideration the fact that these people are in college for sure. They constantly live this in and out, just party life. Nothing's really that serious. Like, you have to take into account that this isn't a family in a suburban area. So the group of kids calls 911 just after 11:55 a.m. that morning. They frantically tell the dispatcher that something bad had happened at their house and one of their roommates got drunk the night before. And now she's unconscious and she hasn't woken up. And they really don't think she's breathing. But when the police arrive a few minutes later, they find something far worse than any of them expected. And I think this is also a point in the case that has bothered the public, that the 911 call came in as one of their roommates passed out, maybe struggling to breathe, when in reality, it was they were dead. Four homicides, like brutal, bloody homicides. It's like, where does that miscommunication come in? But again, hopefully now that I've broke down the story for you, you can understand how these events actually unfolded and kind of make sense. Also, Dylan and Bethany, they have enough guilt. They don't need you to put it on them. Promise I'm pretty sure they already hate themselves enough right now. Like, they just need love and support and validation and understanding at this point because they have gone through hell. And honestly, the public's involvement in this case have only made their lives worse. They didn't do anything anyways. But we keep going. So police arrived in this, like, basically on college campus to this house where there's a different roommate in each bedroom. And they discover Zanna dead on the floor of her bedroom. She's not passed out like they had thought. She is dead. And Zanna was stabbed like 50 times. So she's on the floor of her bedroom, stabbed 50 times. What Dylan has said, what she's told police, is all we know about the noises. And Bethany claims to not have heard anything. It is hard to wrap your mind around, but I don't believe that they did. They did say that they thought... She was playing with a dog because one of the roommates did have a dog, so they thought like the stomping around and running and playing was with a dog. But then she heard what she thought was her roommate saying, "We think there's someone here." And then she heard a man say, "Don't worry." So she got up to look. So police discovered this couple dead in Zanna's bedroom. Then they continue moving up the house because they know that there are two other girls in this house that they haven't heard from. So they go up to Maddie's room and they find Kaylee and Maddie both in Maddie's room in her bed. They could have slept in different rooms, but that night they happen to be both in Maddie's room. There's been neighbor footage of like moaning, like maybe there was some moaning or grunting. There was no like outright screaming. Excuse me. feel like this that noise had to have been pretty loud, right? I mean, it woke them out of bed, so it was loud enough to get them out of bed. Which is a question that everyone has, because they're like, hey, if he would have just thought about anyone other than himself and explained what happened that night, we might have answers to this, because he could say, oh, none of them screamed, or this or that, you know what I mean? But he's not going to say that, because he's a sadist. So both of these girls have been stabbed to death as well. Kaylee has been stabbed over 34 times. Her face was unrecognizable, while Maddie's total is actually not specified. So the autopsy is performed on November 17th. The results show that all four victims were attacked with a large knife and that their wounds were very extensive. The autopsy shows that Zana did fight back. So when putting together the timeline of this investigation, because police are like, who was killed first? What happened here? Why did Dylan and Bethany not hear screaming? Like, what happened here to make this so seamless and fast? But Zana has defensive wounds. So police discovered that Zana had ordered food through the DoorDash app that was delivered around 4 a.m. They believe that Zana and Koberger had either just missed each other in the house, walking through the house while she went to pick up her DoorDash, and then she heard the commotion, and that's why she was even out of bed when she was murdered. Either way, these timelines are very creepy because there are people moving through this house, and we're not sure when they encountered each other. They do, though, suspect that Maddie, Kaylee, and Ethan were asleep at the time of their attacks, which would make sense why it was more quiet, because for two of those victims, they were basically sleeping. And I mean, and then you can kind of, you don't have to like finish attacking one to get to the other. You can move back and forth to try to subdue each other. So maybe that is why it was so quiet. They find, though, that there has been no evidence of sexual assault with any of the victims. Still, investigators feel confident that this was a targeted attack, not completely random. And for the next several weeks, police speak with anyone and everyone who might have had a connection to the victims, including anyone who was spotted with them earlier that night while they were out. But they release little to no updates about the case. I gotta say, this is probably like one of the biggest cases I've followed for a while, that like they literally like by the time it ends and we find out that the police had information from the get-go, like this is the first one that I've had, like I'm amazed how much information they had before they even started talking. Excuse me. And this is the point where you probably heard about the case. We heard about it. I definitely heard about it. Everyone was talking about it. Four college students brutally stabbed to death in the home with two surviving roommates. The case itself just went viral. It spread. No one really knew what happened. 7 weeks after the murders, police made an arrest. A week before they arrested Brian Koberger, court records showed that police had a suspect and the evidence that they had against him that was going to lead to an arrest. Just so you guys know, we could have... I was actually given the court records and whatnot, and I could have leaked that information before anyone else, but we did. Could have sold that shit to TMZ, made a lot of money. But guess what? We didn't. If you're wondering how I got it, sources. And of course, I'm never giving up my source, so just an FYI out there. If anyone ever sends us anything, snitches get stitches, and we're not snitches. It was weird, though, to like read this entire court document. It was long. To understand that they have a suspect, they have evidence, and then go online and see people like, police aren't doing anything. There's nothing going on, and thinking, oh my gosh, they've been investigating this entire time and have kept it away from the public and literally are about to make an arrest. We should have just leaked it. Would have been kind of cool, actually, but I'd probably get in trouble. So 7 weeks after the murders, police make an arrest. The person they arrest, Brian Christopher Koberger, 28-year-old grad student at Washington State University. This is a different college than the victim's college, but it's actually just 10 minutes away from the Idaho campus. Which, at the beginning of this whole case, I actually didn't know. I thought it was the same, because it's like, why go from one campus to another to kill somebody? Like, if you're really that messed up in your head and you want to murder people, why don't you just do it on your own campus? You're already there. And, I mean, you know the campus probably pretty well. So it's basically just two colleges that share the same campus area. On December 30th, 2022, he's arrested at his parents' home, but it's not in Idaho. It's in Pennsylvania. They went across the United States to arrest him, and he was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder. Now let's get a little bit of background on Brian. I wouldn't be spotlighting this if it didn't have some impact on the case. So he has a bachelor's degree in psychology from a university in Pennsylvania, and in the fall of 2022, he'd begin studying his master's in criminal justice across the United States at Washington State. Criminal justice and psychology, it's kind of ironic. Prior to his arrest, he had worked as a security officer for a school in Pennsylvania, where his mother was employed. And he had recently just interviewed for a graduate research assistant position with the Pullman Police Department near his campus. That's kind of funny. So it's safe to say this guy had a clear interest in being some sort of police officer or someone who had a position of power. Now, digging a little further back, it was clear Koberger was troubled long before entering college. You don't do what he did without being hunted. So all the way back to his teenager years, Koberger had written a post online about his struggles with suicidal thoughts, dissociation, and his lack of emotion and feelings of remorse. Basically online saying, like, I'm fearing that I'm a psychopath. Apparently, he also dealt with depression, and according to people who knew him in high school, he had a history of abusing heroin, kind of just like having a lack of empathy. But it was during his graduate studies that things really seemed to amplify for Koberger. Like, maybe he was trying to hold off of this I'm going to be the killer narrative, and was trying to go, well, I'm still be involved in crime because it really interests me, but I'll be a police officer. Seems like when he moved to Idaho and Washington, he was like, you know what, actually, I'm just going to go full force serial killer. Like, I'm going to give in to the dark side. So, in the months before the murders, he posted something on Reddit asking,
your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Asking formerly incarcerated people to take a survey. He wanted to know their, quote, thoughts, emotions, and actions from the beginning to the end of the crime commission process. He said it was part of a research project to understand how emotions and psychological traits influence decision-making when committing a crime. Another classmate of his said he'd recalled just a few days before the murders were committed, Koberger became very curious about forensics, DNA, and other evidence that prosecutors could use to get a conviction in court. And even more terrifying, just prior to the crime, Koberger had been chatting with a woman he met on Tinder. And when they began talking about horror movies, he asked her what she thought the worst way to die would be. She said, I think being stabbed to death. Koberger responded to this woman something to the effect of a K-bar, which is a fixed blade knife, like he specified the type of knife. Sure enough, what was found at the scene of the crime? Not the weapon itself, but a sheath to a K-bar knife. So there was quite a bit of evidence pointing to Brian Koberger circumstantially, which meant things weren't looking good for him leading up to his trial. In fact, more damning evidence against him came out as trial was leading up. And on June 26, 2023, the prosecution announced they would be pursuing the death penalty. Which is a big deal because the state of Idaho hasn't carried out an execution since 2012. So, Koberger's attorneys tried to block that by saying he had been diagnosed with a form of autism. He should be exempt from execution due to the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. But in November 2024, the judge said, no way, absolutely not. The motion stands and the prosecution will be able to pursue the death penalty if Koberger is convicted. Cruel and unusual punishment. How ironic is that? Yeah, and honestly, like, or hypocritical, whatever you want to, if you're talking death penalty cases, killing 4 random people for fun, stabbing them that amount of times in a rage, yeah. That pretty much, like, you're for sure a danger to society, because there is no motive. Like, I feel like we should do, like, instead of a trial, we should just do a USA vote, like, whenever something like this happens, we post a poll online, and everyone votes, and whatever choice is chosen is the choice that's made. So you're leaving it to all the owners of these companies to decide, because they could sway those votes, skew them, lie about them. Or we could just, you know, have the vote somewhere else. But I still think it should be up to the public to make that decision. I mean, it is because of the jury. But, you know, at this point, Brian's team starts reassessing their strategy. And jury selection was scheduled to begin August 4th, 2025. Now remember, these murders happened in 2022, and he was arrested in 2022. So it's been 3 years of back and forth trying to figure out how to get to trial, gathering evidence, appeals, delays, etc., etc. But a month before, on July 2nd this year, Koberger appeared
in the murder of Madison Mogan. How do you plead, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
For the murder of Kaylee Gonsalves, how do you plead, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
The murder of Zanuck Kernodle, a human being, how do you plead, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
The murder of Ethan Chapin, a human being, how do you plead, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Probably because he was about to get the death penalty, so they gave him a plea deal, life in prison, no death. And yet you can see a white Honda Elantra pass his house a few times, circling the crime scene. The future crime scene that's about to happen literally that hour, multiple times, including at 4:04 a.m. This is around the time that the murders were believed to be committed. There's also a security camera that captures audio. This is the one where you could hear like whimpering or dog barking and then a huge thud coming from the home. This happens at 4:17. So at 4:04, the car is circling. They believe it's Brian in his car. And at 4:17, chaos begins. Shortly after that, the Elantra is seen likely literally speeding away from the house at 4 in the morning, like ripping it, tires squealing, and it's in the direction of the Washington State University campus, so where he would be returning to. And around the 29th of November, police track this car to a WSU student named Brian Koberger. So this is how he kind of first comes up on their radar. So now that the police have his name, they look up his record. They find that he had actually been pulled over in Moscow, Idaho, back in August, and during that traffic stop, he had given the officer his cell phone number. So the police are like, hey, we have his cell phone number, which in turn allows them to track where his cell phone was at the time of the murders by accessing his records. Easy enough to get a warrant that once you've seen his car and footage. And with that, they also pull up Koberger's license photo, and sure enough, they find he's a white guy with bushy eyebrows. He looks a lot like the person Dylan described seeing in the house that night. Oh, and by the way, they also discovered Koberger had gotten a new license plate for his car 5 days after the murders were committed. Now let's move on to that location data from his cell phone, because this certainly would have come up in court as well. So after receiving Koberger's cell records, police learned that his cell phone was actually turned off beginning at 2:47 a.m., the morning of the murders. So we know someone was awake on his phone, turning it off around 3 a.m., and its last location that it pinged was in Pullman, Washington, near his campus. Then, someone was awake and the phone mysteriously turned back on at 4:48 a.m., shortly after the suspected time of the murders, and now the phone is in Moscow, Idaho. So while the phone was turned off, it moved. It left its location, went towards the scene of the crime. His data also showed he returned to the area near the crime scene later that morning before the bodies were even discovered. Police and the prosecution believe he was returning, doing a drive-by of the scene to see if police had been called, what had happened, was it taped off. He drives by and realizes what's going on. Excuse me. They believe, you know, knowing that he saw a girl and there's no police there, they haven't called 911. That's why he peeled out so fast. It's because he left someone alive, two people alive, that is. So he does a little drive-by to check up on the case. And also around this time on his phone, he actually took a selfie with a thumbs up, smiling right after he brutally murdered four people. On his phone in his bathroom, he went home after murdering them and took that picture. So they're like, okay, this cell phone data is pretty intense. It's pretty heavy. It does a lot of damage to his case. So they keep digging, and they learn he had actually visited the area around the home at least 23 times in the months before the murders. And when his phone would ping at that home, it was usually between the hours of 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. So basically 23 times before he showed up and actually murdered in the middle of the night, he drove by their house. So we don't know why this house, but we also don't know, was he there only to kill one person? Was his target Maddie and then Kaylee happened to be there, but they can't figure out a connection between them. No one can say that he knew any of the victims. Either one, he saw her in public once and followed her, or one of them, or two, Instagram. Like, they saw him on social media and he's like, oh, that's the person, started stalking them. It's rumored that their house was the host house of many parties where the doors were just left open. I mean, the door was unlocked that night, so people actually believe that Brian could have possibly been in the house and, like, looked at the layout of the house, found whoever his intended victim's room was. Or if it was everyone, like, he could have definitely learned the layout of the house before that night. So it seems like at least one of the roommates in the past month, Kaylee, actually noticed a man watching her at one point when she went out to walk her dog. This is the dog in the story, which is Kaylee's dog. Now remember, Kaylee had actually moved out of the house by the night of the murders. She was literally just back there that night to visit her friends one last time. She wasn't even living there anymore. Which, really, like, that's gotta suck. I mean, you're ready to move on to your with your life. She didn't move because of a stalker, but because she was graduating early, she'd gotten a job, she was ready to, you know, move on. But there was more information I found that showed Kaylee, Zana, and Maddie were actually all being watched by Koberger prior to their deaths. So Koberger followed all the girls on Instagram. He had liked several of Kaylee and Zana's photos, or found them in person and followed them. Either way, he was stalking them on social media and being a weirdo. But this is where the belief that Maddie was the intended target comes in, because she had liked almost every single one of Maddie's posts and had apparently downloaded some of her photos to his devices, which is just so disturbing. Kaylee had also mentioned to friends that she had thought she had a stalker, that someone had mailed her something once and she was getting strange messages on Facebook. Now, we don't know if this is actually connected to him. Then on November 4th, 9 days before the murders, the roommates came home to find that their front door was open, literally off the hinges. It was so bad that Zana's dad actually came over and fixed it. So, some unusual activity. But maybe the biggest piece of evidence in this case, that you probably already know, was a knife sheath that was left at the crime scene. While a knife was never found, the sheath was telling. It was discovered on the bed next to Maddie and Kaylee's body, and it had a Marine Corps logo on it, and it belonged to a K-bar knife. Now, more importantly, forensics was able to extract DNA from the button on the snap of the sheath. Pretty impressive. And while it didn't match anyone in any law enforcement databases, they used genetic genealogy to see if there was a match. So with the help of those consumer databases like Ancestry.com, they built a profile that pointed at that whoever had done this was in the Koberger family. Now, they don't have Koberger's DNA, but they link it to his family tree. To get an exact match, obviously, and absolutely confirm that it's their number one suspect, they need Brian's DNA. They need a sample of his DNA. So a few days before Koberger's arrested, police collect garbage from outside his parents' home in Pennsylvania, where they know Koberger had driven home and was staying at this point. They bring them back to the lab for testing, and when one comes up as a direct match for what was on the sheath, investigators know they have their guy. They have Brian Koberger's DNA on the knife sheath that was left at the crime scene. That's why 3 days later, on December 30th, they were able to finally arrest him, because that's pretty much it. If I was Brian's parents, I'd be pretty pissed if I spent all this money thinking my kid might be innocent. Some people believe that his dad knew what he had done because his dad came to Idaho and drove him back to Pennsylvania after the murder. I don't get that. I don't get standing up. I don't get wanting to defend your kid. And when it comes to something like that, it's not like, oh, he ran a red light, or no. Like, this is, you can love your kid while holding them accountable. In fact, loving your kid while holding them accountable is usually the best thing you can do for them. It's just embarrassing. Before pleading guilty, Koberger's defense attorney motioned to throw the DNA evidence out, basically their strongest piece of evidence, but the request was denied, which also might have pushed Koberger into making the plea deal, because that was the smoking gun. I mean, they've pretty much even admitted that, like, if they didn't have the knife, without the knife, actual murder weapon, and if they didn't have the sheath, this case could have gone a whole different way. Excuse me. But they also had other things that were pointing in his direction. Detectives also found evidence on Koberger's computer once they arrested him, showing that he had purchased a K-bar knife and sheath just months before the killings. And then he searched for a new knife and cover right after the murders. I mean, it's black and white. Open and shut. No, there's no way he didn't do it. So since Koberger's guilty plea, a lot more evidence has actually come to light because the state doesn't really have to keep it on lockdown anymore. So I'll share with you a few details that have come out since his guilty plea. So that selfie, the 10:30 a.m. selfie, is what came out. That look on his face is so creepy. A friend of his also told police he had very obvious scratch marks on his face right after the murders. And they said the same thing happened back in October 2022, a month before the murders. So people began to wonder, did he have a practice victim before this? Koberger's car and house were also... It was originally reported that Koberger's car and house were also meticulously cleaned after the murders, but that was actually just recently proven false. And more eyewitnesses came forward to say that a man was seen lurking around that King Road neighborhood and acting nervous around the time of the crimes. And as far as finding any new evidence inside the house where the crimes took place, this is a very problematic part of this case that I do have a firm stance on, because we will never find more evidence at the King Road house. On December 28, 2023, the University of Idaho decided to demolish the King Road house before he had even pled guilty, saying it was, quote, a grim reminder of the heinous act. Yeah. This was despite the fact that two of the families came forward publicly insisting, no, 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 keep that house standing through trial. Like, keep it standing. What if the jury wants to visit? What if there's more evidence there? Like, who in their right mind made that call? Because, yeah, people that have spoken out on this case have said that, you know, they were definitely probably going to bring a jury there if it went to trial because of the house, how the whole house is all constructed. Like, you'd have to be able to show them. But the school just believed they needed to, like, delete it off the college campus to kind of close that chapter, even though it wasn't legally closed yet. The amount of incompetent people we have making decisions in our lives blows my mind. And that's such an insane decision to make. I will say the prosecutors kind of, they didn't really fight for it. They said the current condition of the premises.
My name is Olivia, and I'm the big sister of Kaylee Gonzalez, and I was blessed to love Madison Mogan as a sister too. I'm not here today to speak in grief. I'm here to speak in truth. Because the truth is, my sister Kaylee and her best friend Maddie were not yours to take. They were not yours to study, to stalk, or to silence. They were two pieces of a whole, the perfect yin and yang. They are everything that you could never be. Loved, accepted, vibrant, accomplished, brave, and powerful. Because the truth about Kaylee and Maddie is they would have been kind to you. If you had approached them in their everyday lives, they would have given you directions, thanked you for the compliment, or awkwardly giggled to make your own words less uncomfortable for you. In a world that rejected you, they would have shown mercy. Because the truth is, I'm angry. Every day I'm angry. I'm left shouting at the inside of my own head everything I wish I could say to you. The truth about me is when I heard the news, I didn't cry. I listened for them. I promised them I would. That I would fight for them, that I would show up, no matter what it cost me. I swore I'd never let them feel alone. Because you see, I've always been their heavyweight. I've always been the one to fight the battles they didn't feel ready to fight themselves. All it ever took was a call, and they knew I would handle it for them, no matter the time, no matter the cost. They could wave their white flag because they knew I would never back down. Not for them, and not even death could change that. Somewhere along the line, I started to think about what I would say to them if I was given just one last chance. If I could gather enough heartbreak or love or sacrifice or whatever it took to get just one message across, what would I say? Throughout this entire process, I've written my feelings down at every moment, my wishes, my love, my denial, my anger. And as one final act of love, I'd planned to read these thoughts, even jarring and discombobulating and not even making sense. Because for me, that was true love. As bare and as naked as it could be, not laced in pretty words or dressed for the occasion, but written through bleary eyes at 2 a.m. with clenched fists, angry at this reality. My true final act of love was to continue on without them, for them. That dream to read aloud my love to them, to bring meaning through pain, was the latest blow in realizing you don't deserve it. And Kaylee and Maddie don't need it. Kaylee and Maddie have always known my love, and they would never ask me to prove it by further victimizing myself to a defendant who has shown no guilt, no remorse, no apprehension. They would say to me, "Why would you give the satisfaction of showing vulnerability now? You promised you would never back down." And for that clarity, I'm thankful. I won't stand here and give you what you want. I won't offer you tears. I won't offer you trembling. Disappointments like you thrive on pain, on fear, and on the illusion of power. And I won't feed your beast. Instead, I will call you what you are. Sociopath, psychopath, murderer. I will ask the questions that reverberate violently in my own head, so loudly that I can't think straight most any day. Some of these might be familiar, so sit up straight when I talk to you. How was your life right before you murdered my sisters? Did you prepare for the crime before leaving your apartment? Please detail what you were thinking and feeling at this time. Why did you choose my sisters? Before making your move, did you approach my sisters? Detail what you were thinking and feeling. Before leaving their home, is there anything else you did? How does it feel to know the only thing you failed more miserably at than being a murderer is trying to be a rapper? Did you recently start shaving or manually pulling out your eyebrows? Why November 13th? Did you truly think your Amazon purchase was untraceable because you used a gift card? How do you find it enjoyable to stargaze with such a severe case of visual snow? Where is the murder weapon, the clothes you wore that night? What did you bring into the house with you? What was the second weapon you used on Kaylee? What were Kaylee's last words? Please describe in detail the level of anxiety you must have felt when you heard the Bearcat pull up to your family home on December 30th, 2022. Which do you regret more? Returning to the crime scene 5 hours later, or never, ever going back to Moscow, not even once, after stalking them there for months? If you were really smart, do you think you'd be here right now? What's it like needing this much attention just to feel real? You're terrified of being ordinary, aren't you? Do you feel anything at all? Or are you exactly what you always feared? Nothing. If you're so powerful, then why are you still hiding, defendant? You see, I'm here today as me. But who are you? Let's try to take off your mask and see. You didn't create devastation. You revealed it in yourself. And that darkness you carry, that emptiness, you'll sit with it long after this is over. That is your sentence. And it was written on the wall long before you ever pled guilty. You didn't win. You just exposed yourself as the coward you are. You're a delusional, pathetic, hypochondriac loser who thought you were so much smarter than everybody else. Constantly scolding, turning your nose up to grammar mistakes, nitpicking and criticizing others. You wanted so badly to be different, to be special, to be better, to be deep, to be mysterious. You found yourself thinking you were better than everyone else, and you thought you could figure out the human psyche and see through it, all while tweaked out on heroin. Lurking in the shadows made you feel powerful because no one ever paid you any attention in the light. You thought you were exceptional, all because of a grade on a paper. You thought you were elite because your online IQ test from 2010 told you so. All of that effort just to seem important. It's desperate. There is a name for your condition, though. Your inflated ego just didn't allow you to see it. Wannabe. You act like no one could ever understand your mind, but the truth is you're basic. You're a textbook case of insecurity disguised as control. Your patterns are predictable. Your motives are shallow. You are not profound. You're pathetic. You aren't special or deep, not mysterious or exceptional. Don't ever get it twisted again. No one is scared of you today. No one is intimidated by you. No one is impressed by you. No one thinks that you are important. You orchestrated this like you thought you were God. Now look at you, begging a courtroom for scraps. You spent months preparing, and still all it took was my sister in a sheath. You work so hard to seem dangerous, but real control doesn't have to prove itself. The truth is, the scariest part about you is how painfully average you turned out to be. The truth is, you're as dumb as they come. Stupid, clumsy, slow, sloppy, weak, dirty. Let me be very clear. Don't ever try to convince yourself you mattered just because someone finally said your name out loud. I see through you. You want the truth? Here's the one you'll hate the most. If you hadn't attacked them in their sleep, in the middle of the night, like a pedophile, Kaylee would have kicked your fucking ass. Thank you.
And that is how she ended her impact statement. And I think if you could write the perfect impact statement about a way to actually get through to a psychopath or a murderer in this regard, she did it perfectly. Reminding everyone and him, you're not special. You're not some crazy smart person because you were able to kill 4 people and people can't comprehend how you could do that. People actually just think you're lame, you're average, and you suck. Like, you're a bad person. That's all people think about you. Well, that was pretty much the summarization, now that the dust has settled, for the most part, around the Idaho college murders. Also, if we had a trial, maybe this is what would have been brought up, the story of the Idaho 4. So, please remember their names, their families, keep them at the forefront. Remember that all 4 of those victims were more than just the Idaho 4 murder victims. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, your support will go back into this channel, help us upgrade our equipment, bring a new host, be able to pay them, and perhaps one day be able to take this show on the road. We'd love to do live reports from trials and court cases or crime scenes like this house, which we could do in the future, because tragically, crime never sleeps. But you can also scan the QR code you see on the screen. And with that, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.